completely model these systems, and you can understand where the power of quantum information comes from and how we can keep that. So the first thing, the first thing I want to say today is of course, quantum mechanics, you know, has a number of unique features to it. It's got unique features in terms of superposition, in terms of strong measurement, in terms of quantum interference, in terms of entanglement, things like that, of course, terms that don't even mean something really in the classical world. We would keep them for their quantum, for our quantum understanding of these. And the neutron interferometry experiment that we've been looking at, of course, touches on the first three of these so far, that we've created a coherent superposition, we look at strong measurement, the third blade, we have interference effects. And later on, we'll be able to add spin. The neutron is a spin 1/2 particle. And so we'll have another degree of freedom. We can also talk about entanglement. So we can use this as a test bed to build intuition about what it means for something to be quantum mechanical. And you saw that somewhat in the tutorials yesterday. So I want to build on that. So let's just I'll put it down over here, actually. Our neutron interferometer. So the neutron interferometer, remember, is a perfect single crystal interferometer, and we have a beam of neutrons coming in. We just defined a coordinate system like this, and we decided that we would define a qubit over the path degrees of the freedom, and our qubit definition is the zero state corresponds to kx greater than zero, and the one state corresponds to kx less than zero. And so we come in the zero state into the neutron interferometer. And at the first blade, there's Bragg scattering, so there's a coherent process. And so much for that. And the neutron is spread over two paths. So it's in a coherent superposition of paths 0 and 1. And so at this blade, we have a unitary process. That looks like that. And we introduced a phase flag here. So we introduced a material in the beam that would delay the neutrons. And so if we thought about the neutrons in terms of their de Broglie wave properties, then this is slowed down. And I'm going to rewrite the phase like this today. It's exactly the same as I wrote last time. Now, I've split it into two. So what I've really done is I've said, there's a phase shift in each of those. And the reason I want to do that is I want to associate that phase with a rotation about the z-axis. Okay? So that's why. And we'll see where that comes in. The third blade, the middle blade, acts as a mirror. I'm going to simplify the unitary for that today as well. I'm going to drop this 90-degree phase shift that we had in the notes. And so I'll just write it as a simple mirror. And of course, you'll remember that what happens at this blade is, again, that we have a diffraction event. So again, we have Bragg scattering. Again, it's in the Lowy geometry. And there would be two paths coming out of this. We put a cadmium beam block here to absorb the neutrons, and we renormalize so that we forget that they were ever there. And so we'll just remove them entirely as well. Okay? And then at the third blade, again, we have the same sort of of unitary that we had at the first blade. But now, of course, there are two inputs and there are two outputs. And so here we see interference. So we've taken a blade that has a well-defined momentum, something we've taken a beam of neutrons that has a well-defined momentum. We've created a coherent superposition overpass, and now here we see interference effects. And then we added two detectors. These are helium-3 detectors, and they're labeled the O and the H beam. And we can write down the operators associated with those measurements, which are, of course, projection operators on the path that we have. We went through the analysis of this. So here we have a perfect unitary analysis. And since it's one qubit, right, there's one two-level system degree of freedom corresponding to the paths. So we can say that we have one qubit. And we know that there's a nice picture of dynamics on one qubit being the Bloch sphere. And so we can take and we can rewrite the dynamics of this experiment in terms of the Bloch sphere. And what do we see? So let's label those. Well, the neutron beam comes in. In the zero state, so it comes in at the north pole of the Bloch sphere. This first operation here creates an interference, but it's a nice special one. It applies a pi over 2 pulse about the y-axis. So it rotates the Bloch vector by 90 degrees about the y-axis. And so we end up over here. And of course, we could rewrite this. This is equivalent to e to the I sigma y. And I include the factor of 2 here because I want this angle to be actually the action. I want that to be correctly represented by the angle that we rotate the system through. And so we come in here, psi n, and the first thing we have is this rotation, which is the first blade. And the next thing we have is this rotation about the z-axis. Now you can see why I wanted to write it like this. And so it has a very compact representation about the z-axis. So it's e to the I sigma z over 2 times phi. And so starting here, we'll rotate by some amount, phi. And so we end up now, again, we're still on the surface of the Bloch sphere, right? But we've rotated in the xy plane. This rotation corresponds to a 180-degree rotation about the y-axis. All of these are easy to figure out, but let's not spend the time now. They're in the notes you've seen. And so we end up rotating 180 degrees about the y-axis to here. So this is the effect of the mirror. And now, of course, that angle is phi. Could make it a nicer phi. And the third blade, well, it does exactly what the first blade does. It rotates us by 90 degrees. And so we rotate back up. And now I apologize for my drawing skills. But we rotate back up here by 90 degrees. And so this final vector ends up in the yz plane, Okay, so if you're drawing it, you can make that more clear than I have. Okay, but that'll end up in the YZ plane. And of course, what we do is we make a measurement here of the projection into this state and into the one state, right? So we make two measurements that are effectively going to give us sigma z. And we know that if we go through and do this, that the probability of making a measurement here, so our intensity, is 1 plus. Hey, 1 plus cosine phi divided by 2, and the intensity in the H beam is 1 plus cosine phi divided by 2. And so if we plot this up, we'll see these two curves for the O and the H beam. And one nice thing is that they add up to 1. They would add up to 1 if I got my sign right. Now they'll add up to 1. Okay. And I want you to remember what we're plotting on this axis. Right here, we're making an expectation measurement. So how does this work? Well, we set up our neutron interferometer. We set it up outside of a reactor. We have a beam of neutrons coming in. It's actually a pretty big beam. It's 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. So it has some area to it. The neutrons have roughly equal probability of being anywhere within that beam. There's a flux of neutrons that impinge. Effectively, we have a neutron a second or a few neutrons a second in this cross-sectional area. And now I'm talking only about those neutrons that have the right energy, because that's the only ones I care about. And they come through and they hit one of these two detectors. And remember the probability of detecting out here. If a neutron hits the detector, we have a very, very high probability that we'll actually detect that neutron. We detect it as a voltage. And something I didn't tell you last time is that if, you know, the miraculous event that we would have two neutrons hitting one detector at the same time, we would actually see a greater energy. So we could suppress those events. So we'll really think about this as a one neutron experiment. And now then, we've got this piece, and we say, okay, we're going to count. We're going to set the phase flag here to some value. And then we're just going to count the number of neutrons that hit each of those detectors. We're going to count for some period of time. So we'll count for a minute. That's too short. We'll count for 10 minutes. And then we'll get some number. And this axis is the observed count. Per unit time. For whatever interval, let's say an interval better than time. And so you'll see in the notes that axis has numbers of on order of 1,000, that's what we're counting. And if we're making an expectation value measurement, then there's rules imposed upon us. The first rule is that every neutron that comes through that we put into the experiment should be the same, right? They shouldn't be distinguishable. Otherwise, we're not allowed to just add the statistics. And the setting of the instrument should remain the same over all of that time. Okay, so those are the rules that we play by in order to have a valid expectation value measurement. All right, so that's taken longer than I thought. So now then, given this, Let's ask, what are the essential questions? So if I just gave you this idealized model and we had this unitary dynamics on the Bloch sphere and asked you, how do you see interference effects? How do you show that quantum interference is not like waves out in the pond behind us, right? That is pretty easy. You can go through, you can do that. And we gave you a piece to look at last time. But the real question is, if you have a system with imperfections, can you still see uniquely quantum mechanical dynamics? All right, so that's question one. I want to know that I can see uniquely, I'm going to keep that word uniquely, quantum dynamics in the system, even in the case of imperfections. And what I mean by uniquely is that you cannot write a classical picture of that dynamics without adding to the complexity of the problem. Okay? So that with the resources we give you, there's no classical picture that would give you the same outcome. Okay, that's what we mean by uniquely. So the first question is, you know, we add a bit of noise, and you saw the data set, right? The data set that we showed you, the best data set, which we always call typical. That, of course, doesn't have this structure. Okay. Now the second thing is I think more timely. The first question, you know, it's been asked since the 20s. But this is the second question is more timely. The second question is, can we engineer a quantum system so that it behaves uniquely quantum mechanical? Now, you know that IQC and Perimeter, we're trying to build quantum devices. We dream about building quantum computers. And, you know, our computer scientist colleagues tell us, if you can do this, you can do something fantastic, something that couldn't be done in the classical world. And so if we build those devices, they better have uniquely quantum behavior, right? Because if, you know, we could model them classically without adding resources, then certainly they couldn't do something classically, quantum mechanically, that we couldn't do classically. Okay, so it's a question. So now, the old approach to engineering systems is to say, let's just suppress the noise. So you say, oh, I'm going to put my quantum system, and I'll put it in a magnetic shield. I'll put it in a Faraday shield to keep it away from electric field noise. I'll put it in a vibrationally isolated room. I'll put it in an acoustically isolated room. All those things actually were done with the neutron case. I'll make it really cold. We don't need to do that in the neutron case, but, you know, we'll say, ah, you come over to my lab, you'll see lots of dilution refrigerators. We'll go down to 5 millidegree Kelvin, and we'll suppress the phonons. And the old approach says, if you want something to behave quantum mechanically, you should remove all the imperfections that are making it appear classical, or that are bringing you closer to classical, or giving you some classical loopholes. The new approach says, hey, we can engineer quantum information processing ideas. We can apply those, and we can make systems that are robust, that they'll be resilient against noise. The uniquely quantum behavior will still be there in the presence of noise. Now, you may have to know where to look for it, okay? But that's what we want to get to here. We want to show you that we can engineer, this is new now, we can engineer a quantum system so that it will be resilient to noise. And we don't have to rely upon this burdensome process of putting everything into some environmentally shielded place to keep it away from the noise. Clearly, if we need a dilution refrigerator or need a vibrationally isolated lab to use a sensor, then there isn't much in nature you're going to sense with that, right? Okay. Now, we're going to come back to this, but let's just take this picture and ask, well, where did the noise come in, right? I mean, this is a really simple piece. So let's ask, well, where does the noise come in this one? Let me ask you. Give me some ideas of where noise comes in. I don't have to tell you everything. Yeah?
The difference between those two patterns?
So that is very well put. If something about the experiment distinguishes these two paths, then we would say, ah, we expect that the quantum degrees of freedom will go away, right? So absolutely, we want to make sure that as we are building this system, those things that might distinguish the paths are suppressed. And the biggest noise in this system is to have a small rotational vibration about that axis. Because you can see what happens is that the Bragg scattering event, the middle blade, changes as I rotate that. And it'll distinguish which path. The same thing actually happens if our neutron interferometer is bouncing up and down. And that is really, really small events. If I rotate the neutron interferometer by 10,000ths of a degree, I've changed everything. Okay, so absolutely, you've chosen the hardest piece right off. It's nice you've done that because that one we can solve. So I'll show you later on that we can get rid of that, the hardest piece. That's my definition of a good experiment, that you solve the hard problems first. There are other sources of noise. Someone else want to offer one up? Well, there could be one on the input, right? Here we have said that we have one unique state, that the only neutrons come in here. But of course, this blade is just like this one. And so there could be noise because we have a neutron impinging there. Okay. Now, I told you that these phase flux are made of silica. Remember that the interferometer is made of silicon, single crystal silicon. But the phase flag is made of silica, one, because it's not single crystal, it's amorphous. So it's not going to Bragg scatter. But also, the phase shift in silica is pi for 40 microns. And when we machine these things, we're very careful. But the size of the beam is pretty big. And if I told you that I wanted to have two surfaces that were square to each other, and square to each other over a centimeter, and the variation shouldn't be a few microns, it's very hard to machine like that. We don't have those machining capabilities readily available. We're still, actually, it's a research project to develop those. And so you can think about this piece here as, there'll be some roughness on this. It'll be on both sides. And of course, the same thing will happen here, and the same thing will happen here. But this is a phase. It looks like, of course, a Z rotation. And so I can always take this phase and I can put it on the inside. And the phase that's on the inside here, and of course, this is just a Z rotation, so they all commute. And so effectively, I just end up with one big Z rotation. But you can see what happens is that this phase becomes a function of X and Z, right? It's a function of where you are on that blade. And so now then, remember we made a promise. We said, hey, we're going to do an expectation value measurement. We'll treat every neutron that's coming in the same. And now we're violating that. We're saying, if a neutron comes in and goes through here, it's going to see a different experiment than if it comes in and goes through slightly shifted. And so what we'll find out is that we're going to be treating the experiment as a convex sum over a set of experiments. And that's going to give us a unique signature of the overall dynamics. And all of these things are going to push us into the center, into the interior of the Bloch sphere. And so we wanted to look at the physics of how do we describe a system that is pushed in interior to the Bloch sphere. You know how to describe a system on the surface of the Bloch sphere, simple unitary rotations. But now, what do we do when it's pushed inside? Now, of course, there's one more error there's a lot of errors. Neutrons have mass, and so there's a gravitational phase. And a neutron interferometer is a great way to watch the moon rise, unless you're trying to get some data for something else. But you can see the moon rise. Of course, it has spin, so that there are magnetic fluctuations. You can see that. So if somebody in the next lab is turning on a magnet, your experiment goes off in left field. And of course, neutrons have a lifetime, right? And so even though a neutron enters here, it may not exit, right? Now, of course, we're only counting those neutrons that actually hit our detector. We never know when a neutron enters the experiment. So the lifetime issue for this particular experiment isn't a problem. Okay? Good. So now then, what we want to do is to turn to looking at dynamics on the Bloch sphere. So let's see what we got here. And what we're used to is describing the evolution of a density matrix as, of course, the commutator of the density matrix with some Hamiltonian. But we'll just integrate that, and we'll describe it. In terms of a unitary evolution, okay? And of course, here I'm assuming that there's a time-independent Hamiltonian, or that we've integrated this. But you know, it's easiest to keep the model that the whole thing's time-independent for the Hamiltonian. Yeah. And we saw last class, of course, that we went through the dynamics, and so we could say, oh yes. We have this unitary times this one, and we could generate an effective unitary out of all those rotations, exactly as we did here. And exactly as you see with this rotation plot, the order matters, right? So if I scrambled those rotations, we would get something completely different. Okay, things you already know. So now we're going to change this. We're going to say that the evolution of the system, and what did I use for a coordinate? Looks like a convex sum over a set of actions. Now, this is not by any means the most general. Okay, so my task here isn't to, in one lecture, cover everything you would see in a course in open quantum systems. And if you come to Waterloo, Joseph Emerson teaches a beautiful course in that, and he has a textbook which he doesn't ever get around to publishing, but he shares with people. So we weren't going to talk about the most general thing, but let's start here. And so we say that we have some probability of a particular action, some probability of a rotation. And that there's, of course, a parameter. This is just a dummy parameter. Now, if we were looking at the imperfections of this blade, then, of course, we would integrate over the spatial coordinates x and z. Okay, here I just say, we have some dummy variable z that says, let's keep track of all the probabilities. Yeah. Notice that for any value of that, we're still saying the action's unitary. Right, so we haven't said anything about the action not being unitary. It's still unitary for every element of this distribution. And we've said that the incoming piece doesn't depend upon that coordinate, right? The incoming state is independent of this. Again, that's not necessary, but it is very convenient. It saves us looking at the process. All right, so we have this probability distribution. And we will require the probability distribution, normalization, everything else that you would like for this. Now, if we describe our dynamics this way, then if the initial density matrix is a valid density matrix, the final density matrix will be a valid density matrix. Okay, so that is good. The other thing that will happen naturally from such a definition is that the only thing we'll do is lose purity. We won't gain purity, we'll just lose purity. So if you're familiar with completely positive maps, this will always be a completely positive map. If you're not familiar with that, it doesn't matter. All you need to know is that if something is a valid density matrix, it better have trace one. And if we're talking about the purity, then we can look at trace rho squared. And if trace rho squared is equal to one, then we're sitting on the surface of the Bloch sphere. In this dynamic, the only thing it can do is take you inside the Bloch sphere. It would be a problem if it could take you outside. Okay. Now, if I'm looking at such a process, imagine that I put two of these back to back. So that I would say that I have some action, and then row two. And we'll integrate over z to get rho out as a function of time. And let's call that t2, and let's call that t1, and t0, sorry, and t1. Yeah, let's just keep the times different. These are intervals, right? Remember that our definition up here, right? That's an interval. It says I've applied that unitary for this amount of time. Okay? Now, clearly, this piece here, I could define as a density matrix, rows as a function of this coordinate, z. And of course, if I integrated over that, so I could integrate over that, and I could get rho prime of t1, but I better not put this up in here and then integrate separately, right? Because here I'm saying, hey, those two depend on this parameter z in a connected way. And that's essential, right? So if I look at the average of the product, that's not equal to the product of the averages, right? So don't average here and then apply that to another process. So when we come over here and we say, oh, I know that there's going to be some errors here, and there'll be some errors here, and there'll be some errors here. Okay? We're going to write that all out, and then we'll integrate over the whole process. Yep? Perfect. Okay. Now then, notice what happens. If I go ahead and I look at this, this probability distribution takes on a very important role. It defines the range of actions that we have in the system. And when I collapse down and treat the density matrix outside of that probability distribution, here I have a very compact representation. Right? Here I have a very verbose one. I say, oh, I have this continuum of unitaries, and that continuum of unitaries has a set of probabilities associated with it. I need to say one more thing. This is really a probability, right? This is a classical probability distribution. This is not a probability amplitude. Yeah? It says, hey, you have these events. Okay, so one could ask, is there a mapping from those which is compact? And there is. So we can define this process in terms of Krauss operators, which is a compact representation of the overall action of this process or that process, or this process. And the reason to think about these Krauss pictures is because at the end of the day, we probably want to suppress what happens over this distribution, right? That distribution is taking us inside the Bloch sphere. It's making the system more and more classical, probably. And I would like to suppress it. So I'd like I wouldn't like to have to keep track of that distribution for everything I want to do. And so then we can say, oh yes, instead of having this, I'm going to have a compact representation. And now I suspect that's new to you, right? Krauss operators? Anyone heard about them? So if a few people have heard about them, we'll talk about them a little bit more. Now, of course, let's just keep ourselves in SU2 for a second. So if I have SU2, then we know that the Pauli operators span SU2. And of course, we can write them down. We could even try to get them correct. And of course, they have really nice properties, right? That if we look at the commutation relations of them, x, y will always give you z, and cyclic permutations of that holds up. And of course, the lovely, lovely piece that they square to identity. So that if I try to evaluate this matrix exponential and I write the exponential down in terms of a power series, then all of the even terms I can replace as being proportional to the identity, all the odd terms proportional to y, and we immediately see a compactation of that. And you've all seen that in your quantum mechanics course. Good. Okay. So now then I say, oh, I've got these four operators. And of course, that's a valid basis on both sides of this. So then we can define a superoperator that is the map between the amplitudes of those operators. So we have a superoperator. Now, because it's a map between all four of the polys to all four of the polys, it had better be 4x4. Right? So the superoperator is going to live in a larger space called the Liouville space. And it's going to tell us as we look at these 4x4 elements, what are the mappings between these? And so if we want to have a unital dynamic, so I want to keep the identity constant, then we'll fix that, right? So identity is always mapped to identity. Yeah, it's not necessary again, but it's a nice set of channels. And then we could say, what happens in these pieces? Well, it's pretty easy. You know, think about a unitary process. If I took this pi rotation about y, well, the pi rotation about y maps z to x, it maps x to z, it maps y to y, right? And so we have a very compact representation here. And it's so compact, you say, I don't need that, right? I know the unitary operator, yeah? But now we're doing something different. We're going to say, I'm going to average over all of this process and look at the dynamics. And so now then, we can go and we can write down the superoperator pretty directly. If I want to calculate the superoperator for this particular distribution, all I need to do, I should have saved myself some room, but all I need to do is replace the input state with each of the polys, right? And so I could say, I'll take sigma x or sigma y or sigma z as my input. We'll apply the exact same transform. We still want to average over all the probabilities, so we'll get out we'll look at some averaging of this. We'll get out a state. In the unital case, I know that it's going to be spanned by x, y, and z. And I want to know how much, right? Well, that's easy, because we know that we know that the poly matrices are traceless. And we know that they square to the identity, right? And so in order to know, what's the weighting here, I can look at the trace of this output. Let me call this rho of x, rho of y, rho of z, right? We have those pieces. And so then the coefficient there, the coefficient of ij is equal to the trace of sigma I rho j. Yeah? I suppose I needed to divide by the dimension, right? I think so. Don't take my word for that. I'm not responsible for any factors of two, barely responsible for negative signs, okay? But now you can build up the superoperator. And you can do it compactly. And if you go through the notes, you'll see all that in there. Okay? And there's some problems to work through. Work through some problems. You'll learn more. But it's formally very simple to do. Now, this operation gives us the superoperator. What I really would like is a set of Krauss operators. And the Krauss operators says that rho out, is equal to the sum over operations m sub I rho m sub I dagger. And this has, save I for other things. N has the dimension of the Hilbert space squared, right? So in this case, it's better be 4. Okay? Let's be N squared. Now there's a requirement here that the sum of the products of this is equal to the identity. And that's this requirement here. That is sufficient. It's necessary and sufficient that the map be completely positive. Okay. This map, the superoperator, need not be. Superoperator is a more general representation. It can define, you can write down a superoperator for any wild thing. But if you can reduce it to a Krauss map, then you know that it's completely positive. Now let's just work through a few examples. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take and require that the Krauss operators are proportional to a poly, and that the weighting is the square root of a probability. Okay, so again, I'm making it more and more special. But it's a nice picture, and it'll be sufficient for our needs. Okay? So, let me just take and look at the noise that we had here. We said all this surface noise is going to end up being a noise on the rotation of Z. So let's just look at that. So we'll have a process. It's called the dephasing channel, but that's not so important. But you must have heard about that in Dan's class. Yes, okay, good. So then we can say, we have two operators. I have one operator that is the square root of 1 minus p, the identity, and another operator, which is the square root of p sigma z. Yeah? And we can immediately look at this. Now, of course, in general, there are more operators. But for a dephasing channel, this is sufficient. And then we can say, if I look here, then, of course, identity times identity is 1, right? And so if I look at the first term of this, we'll find out that we have a probability of 1 minus p. If I look at the second one, sigma z times sigma z is the identity. And it comes in with a probability of p. And so, yes, in fact, this is true. Yep. So we're happy. Okay. So now then, let's just expand it out. So we say that we have rho. And I didn't say this, but let me say it. We typically think about noise as acting infinitesimally, and then that we could integrate it over time. And many of the nicest features of noise are in stochastic and in Markovian systems, where we can say as a noise acts over and over again, effectively it's acting randomly. It's not a requirement, but it's a motivation for me putting dt here, where I'm thinking about this action as being infinitesimal, and then if I want to know what happens over a longer time, I can integrate it. We can, of course, define a map over any time period. But let's do it this way, because what I would like to do is to, by the other end of the board, show you that we can rewrite Bloch's equations for motion on the Bloch sphere. Okay? So then I want this to be infinitesimal. Okay, so then we say that what we have is we're going to apply those Krauss operators. And it would be nice if I identified P as being P of some time is equal to time divided by the typical dephasing time that you would have in a block equation. Okay? And we won't have time today, but I'll come back and I'll justify that next class for you. Okay? So then we say, oh yes, I've got these two terms. M sub 1 is the square root of 1 minus t dt over t2. The identity, M sub 2, is equal to the square root of dt over t2 sigma z. And we simply go ahead and apply them. Now, I would like out of this to get something that looks like that super operator. So let's go ahead and apply this for each individual element. We of course know here that we've got this identity term. So we'll write that one out. It says that, yep, I have a term that comes in as rho n, that piece of it. And I have a term that comes in as minus dt over t2 times rho n. And I have a term here that comes in as plus dt over t2. And it will be sigma z rho n sigma z. The transpose of sigma z is sigma z. So we're happy with that. Good. And now then, we'll take a look at rho n. I want to do one more thing. I should always follow my notes. I never do. Let's look at d rho n dt. Right? So I'll just subtract this from that side. That'll give me the difference. And I'll divide out rho n, and we'll end up with rho n divided by t2 plus sigma z rho n sigma z divided by t2. Yeah?
The sign should be different.
Thank you. That'll be important. So, we take rho n associated with sigma z, and then we see that d sigma z dt is equal to minus sigma z over t2 plus sigma z, sigma z, sigma z over t2. But this thing is sigma z, and so this is equal to 0. Now, of course, that's what we expect, right? We're saying that there's some dephasing about this axis. But if we have an operator and we're looking at actions over even a range of Hamiltonians that it commutes with, it'll have no fluids at all, right? So this is fine. And then we can go and look at dx. Now, sigma z ix, you'll recognize as being I sigma y. And sigma y sigma z, you recognize as being I sigma x. Okay, and so we pick up a negative sign here. And so this thing is equal to twice sigma x over t2. And similarly for sigma y, dt, it's equal to twice sigma y over t2. And now then we have a very nice mapping. It says, well, what happens under this compact representation, under this set of Krauss operators? Well, we get the super operator that says that z stays the same, the identity stays the same in this. So both of those two. And the other two terms decay, but they don't rotate. They simply decay. And they decay as 2 over t2 in both of those models. Okay, and so we have here a super operator that would act on a vectorized density matrix, right? And we can see those dynamics. Okay, so unfortunately, I didn't get quite to defining the full block equations, but I will do that next class. But let's see where we are. What we've said is that we have our quantum system, and that we know what imperfections to put in there, and that we can put in those imperfections. We can put them in terms of this distribution function, right? The distribution function is going to be something that's physically motivated. It says, hey, I know the roughness of a blade. I know the amplitude of a rotation. I know the photon energy that's coming in. Right? That P of Z, that's physically motivated. We know where that's coming from. We can put it in there. And then, very quickly, we can say, hey, I don't want to have to deal with the complexity of that distribution. And so then I can integrate over that, and I can come up with two different representations. I can come up with a superoperator representation that tells me what is the overall map. How is the system going to behave given this open system dynamics? Or I can write it down in terms of this Krauss map that says, hey, give me an even more compact representation. Just tell me the amplitudes of a few operators, right? Now, of course, in writing down these representations, we lose connection with some of the physics. And if we were taking the old-fashioned approach and saying, hey, I want to build my device so that the vibrations are smaller, or I want to build my device so that there's less phonon energy, we couldn't afford to lose track of those distributions, right? Because those distributions are what we're engineering. But we're taking a different approach. We're saying, hey, I don't need to impose that burden on myself of engineering those distributions. We have this whole quantum state that is the more interesting part of that integral. I'm going to do my engineering over those quantum processes, not over the classical bits. And now then, with that in mind, it's enough to replace it with the map and deal with the map in looking at those dynamics. And when you were looking, when you took Daniel's course, then he went over quantum error correction with you. And so you could immediately take this map and write down a compact code that would remove that error, right? All it takes is 3 qubits, and this error is history, as long as you can add those 2 additional qubits without adding noise, some small miracles that you need to engineer in your system. Okay? So good. So let me leave it here. We'll pick up tomorrow. I give you 2 notebooks to look at. 1 notebook describes generating the super operator, and it goes through lots and lots of examples of connecting them to physical processes. The other notebook is shorter, and I'm not going to go over it, but maybe you want to do it in tutorial or not. What it does is it tells you how to go from a super operator to the Krauss operator picture. It allows you to go between these two. And there's the so-called Troy matrix that describes how to do that. And you can either treat that notebook as just a functional call and say, hey, here's a function that does that. Or you can explore it a little bit more detail if you want to understand why it works. Okay. But you can go in that direction. Remember, I mean, going from here to here is trivial, right? Because we just described it right there. Okay, I've got a probability distribution which has all of two elements, and I've got my operators. So going from here to here, just integrate that. The integral turns into a sum, life is good, immediate gratification. Going from here to here is only possible when this is completely positive, but when it is completely positive, then the Troy matrix tells you how to do it. Good, thanks. So I was going to show you the notebook, but you can go through it yourself, so I won't take the time to put it on the board today. Thanks.